They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Dead Dad, a horror podcast.
Brought to you by Big Baby Studios.
Hello and welcome to the Dead Air Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Chris, and that's the horror-obsessed one to anyone who actually follows the podcast. I'm joined by my favorite scaredy cat co-host, Miguel. Please say hi.
Hey, everyone. It's Miguel. Nice to be back after a few weeks of being inactive because of work.
Absolutely. And our returning guest host, Ramon De Vera from the very popular podcast, Enslaved. Welcome, guys. Ramon?
Hello.
So that is Dead Air, and today's guest is a very special one. She is an Emmy Award-winning director with extensive credits in theater, film, and television. Her latest film is making quite the noise in the indie horror circuit. It's the psychological thriller Follow Her, which is currently just came out on VOD. So please welcome Sylvia Kaminer.
Hey, Sylvia.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining
us. Good to be here. Yeah, glad you guys reached out.
Thank you. It's quite the honor for you to come on. We're very excited to have you on, Sylvia. So I actually discovered Follow Her quite recently, I was looking up a lot of interviews of yourself online, and you know, I could just to prepare for this podcast actually. Right. I was very interested to find out that this was actually your first feature with you directing. You produced so much before, worked in television and theater, and also producing your own films. But this is your actual first feature, and that was the first thing that stood out for me.
First fiction. I've done a couple of documentaries. Yes. Different.
First
completely
fiction.
Completely different. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. I saw it, and then I immediately want to see if I could try to get in touch with you to see if you could come on. And here we are. So thank you very much for accepting.
Yeah, no, thanks for reaching out.
So again, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've worked in theater, you've worked in film, you've worked in television. So what kind of drives your need to be in the storytelling industry? Can you tell us about your beginnings?
Sure. Well, I think I was one of those kids that was obsessed with films and the whole experience of going to theaters, you know, and just escaping into another world. And I think it actually even started, I lived in New York City as a kid. I grew up going to like Broadway shows and a lot of revival screenings and seeing plays in front of me on Broadway, like, you know, third row, fourth row. I had an aunt that would take me. And I think that really just opened something up inside me of wanting to tell stories, of loving that traveling, you know, going off on a story. And then, you know, for horror in particular, I used to read a lot, and it's Stephen King all the way. The Stand in probably the seventh grade. Yeah. I mean, that was my favorite book. I read it a few times, and anything he wrote, I wanted to read. And then when, you know, some of those movies were coming out, I still remember the anticipation of when they finally made The Stand into, I don't know if you guys saw it, but mm-hmm. The TV movie, I think they broke it into either two or three parts. I was so excited for that.
Yeah, the miniseries.
Yeah. I mean, they had done it, but The Stand was always my book, and I keep hoping they're going to do it again, update it.
They actually did update it a year ago.
Oh, you're right. Of course they did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys see it? I don't know.
I saw it. Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah.
What's it like, Chris?
It's interesting. Not the biggest fan of it, but it's,
didn't quite grab me. I don't even think I saw the whole series.
Yeah,
I think because maybe it was such a favorite for us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe,
yeah. And I think biased. I watched a lot of... Yeah, so I watched a lot of creepy films. I remember watching The Shining as a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, even like The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby and, you know, so.
All excellent choices for a child.
I had a lot of nightmares as a kid. So mom and dad, I don't know what they were thinking.
Were they into darker films?
No. No, not in the slightest. They would have been like, what are you watching? No, in fact, you know, my aunt would force us to go see movies like Singing in the Rain and stuff because we were wanted like dark. And no, I think I was the youngest. And I think that my sisters also were not, didn't have this love for macabre stuff. I don't know. Yeah, no one in my family's in the business or was ever, you know, I was the one that they all thought, oh, she's a little crazy because I would want to see movies more than once. And, you know, I spent all my time on magazines about movies as a kid and stuff.
Nice. Are you updated with the horror scene now in recent years?
Somewhat. It's been such a busy year that I haven't seen everything. I have seen a bunch. There's a few I still need to see. I just watched The Boogeyman. I really love Black Phone. You know, I saw Nope, which is not quite horror. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. But and then, you know, being on the festival circuit, you get to see a lot of movies that aren't out yet.
That's true. So
that's really fun. Yeah, the festival, being especially like having produced a lot of straight, you know, dramatic or comedic films, the festival circuit is so completely different when you're on the genre circuit.
Yeah, sure.
I can't compare. You know, I love straight festivals, I'll call them, you know, like dramatic festivals, but they're so much more fun. I have to say the genre audiences are, I don't know, they're fans.
Yeah.
they're really passionate. Take it to, yeah, they're very passionate. They kind of take it to another level. Mm-hmm. And the people running the festivals tend to be really, really passionate, you know, about horror or thrillers or So that's a really fun part of, as a filmmaker, it's such a fun part of the process.
Fantastic. Have you seen any Asian horror?
I have. Oh my gosh, of course. You know, I've seen a lot of the stuff that's on TV, like the series and stuff, the Netflix, but yeah, I was at, gosh, what were I had? I'm terrible with names also because I just watched so much, but yeah. I was at a festival in Portugal called Fanasporto, and they have a whole portion of the festival dedicated to Asian horror. And I have to, oh gosh, I've seen so many. And South Korea makes some amazing films. Incredible. And I can't think of the names, but I saw a few, like I would flock to especially, I have to say Korean, not to put, I just have noticed that so many of the films that I've really liked have come from South Korea.
Yeah. They have a very incredible filmmaking culture.
They do. And of course that's a culture that they've been so, I mean, they lead the field in a sense, as far as like they've been doing horror and genre for a long time. And there's a lot of new filmmakers coming up I'm sorry, I can't remember the names. There was,
no, it's cool.
That's fine. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. That's really cool. Okay. Why don't we just jump straight into why we're here, which is really, we would love to talk to you about your first film, Follow Her, which again is out right now on VOD. Do you mind giving us a very quick synopsis about Follow Her?
Sure. So it's about a woman who is a, you know, struggling actress who's trying to make a living as a influencer. And she's a part of this kind of, it's a make-believe for the film world where you can, you know, the bigger audience you get, the more money you can make. And she's trying to create an audience by filming the wackiest jobs she can find online and secretly live streaming her experiences. And she goes off on a particular job to help write the ending of a screenplay with a very good looking Australian man. To her surprise, she thinks he's going to be some loser. And she goes down, she takes some pretty big risks because she's desperate to build her audience and she's losing her apartment. And so he's not who he seems. And it kind of becomes a battle of wits and whether she will survive or not.
Awesome. So how did you come across Danny Barker's script?
You know, I've been making movies and producing films in the city for a while in New York. And so I have a filmmaker friend who was kind of a mentor to me, John Gallagher. And Danny had heard John talking on a podcast, something like this.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, except John hadn't made horror films, but he's made a bunch of films. And so she reached out to him. She's like, oh, this guy sounds great. it was her first film that she'd written as a full screenplay, and she'd written it for herself to star in, but she needed a director and someone that could help her figure out how to get it made. And so she reached out to John, and John put us in touch. And, you know, as soon as I read it, I was like, ooh, there's really interesting things here to dig your teeth into. And I've been looking specifically for a genre film. I've read so many scripts. Oh my, I knew the first one I directed, I wanted it to be a genre film. I initially thought it was going to be this other script that I wrote, but it's too big of a film, very dramatic. And I was like, you know what? Just get, you know, find a script that isn't going to be too expensive that you can get done. You don't need names for genre, although it does help, I will say. And so I knew, and I just thought, you know, I love that world. I love taking people on a ride. And yeah, genre just allows you to really talk about stuff that maybe you couldn't in drama. And I think there's just a passion for it around the world, you know, and you can maybe reach out to different cultures, whereas like a straight dramatic film has, I think, is more limited, you know, in comedy. So yeah, so I read it, we had a call, and we kind of, from that first call, we're like, okay, let's do it. I'll trust that you can pull off that act, that, you know, the acting, because she was the star and I had not really seen her in anything. I was like, oh my goodness, that's a huge risk. And then she had to believe that I could direct fiction.
leads me to my next question, actually, because like your resume is very extensive, as you know, working in as a producer and a documentarian, but like this is your first full feature. And like, so how do you make that switch? Is it a natural transition, or is it something that you always really wanted to do?
Yeah, you know, the documentary portion of my career was the surprise. You know, I always saw myself as a fiction filmmaker, you know, producing fiction. And then I thought I'd be directing films 10 years ago, you know. But then, you know, life takes you into different directions. I actually left New York City. My dad got sick and he was living in Florida. I had a boyfriend at the time that lived here. I was going to get married. Like, life was taking me in a direction. And I was like, well, shit, there's no film industry in Florida. There really isn't. But I was like, you know, I also have a real passion for travel. So I was like, well, maybe I can take a break from the indie New York film scene, which was kind of burning me out. And so I kind of got into, that's when I kind of got into the travel world of making unscripted television, you know, these travel shows. And from there, I got into documentary storytelling. And, you know, I always have felt that I'm so glad I started, well, in theater, so I was very comfortable working with actors, but I'm so glad I started in fiction, because in fiction, everything is about story. You know, everything's about an arc for characters and a hook and tension. And so I feel like I brought that to my documentary filmmaking, you know, and I think, you know, it's all storytelling.
Yeah, exactly. So,
you know, if you can, because I've heard, you know, I've made a couple of feature docs, and I've heard that they do kind of feel a little bit like a feature, you know, like there's clear hooks, and I hope, you know, and they're entertaining. They're not, you know, which I love documentaries.
How big is the change in the dynamic from on set, you know, from working on documentaries as to working on a full feature?
Could not be more different. In documentaries, like, for instance, I did a film in Africa, in Tanzania, the country of Tanzania. And I went with me, I had two cameramen and the subjects. And we just filmed for like 7 weeks. We didn't have days off. We were just like going where the story took us. So it was very quick. And you had to be so fast to know, like, yes, go in this direction with the story for that particular documentary. So then on the feature, you know, I have actors who have to deliver lines, and they have to be believable, and they need coaching, some more than others, you know. And then you've got, on this film, we had a smaller crew than I'd ever worked with. We probably had, you know, 20 people, which is really small. You know, even on indie films I'd done, we had 50, 60 people. So I'm very thankful that I had been on film sets before, on narrative sets, because I kind of knew the dynamic and how things worked. But yeah, it's very, very different. There's a lot of waiting on a film, you know, a lot of time is spent, you know, with lighting and getting the set ready. And we tried to, you know, get that done quickly because we had limited time. And then you're working with actors. So it's, yeah, it almost couldn't be more different. But I feel like each step of my path aided me in being ready.
Sure.
For this, you know, the theater, producing, and producing a lot of first-time filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Also learning, you know, what mistakes not to make, mm-hmm. you know, and seeing what worked. And John Gallagher was very good at having very creative sets where actors felt very safe and very free, you know, mm-hmm. Especially to like use improvisation and stuff, which we did quite a bit of. Luke Cook, who plays the male lead, is brilliant at that. And he brought some real, yeah, fun yeah. lines to the film. And yeah.
He's a funny guy. I follow him on Instagram.
Oh, you do? He's hysterical. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Quite yeah. a funny guy.
Oh my God. He should be on Saturday Night Live. Like he would be the funniest person on the show. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's very funny. He's very zany. Mm-hmm. He's really smart with his humor. So mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. He brought a lot.
Which experience do you prefer, working on documentaries, producing, or now directing your first your feature?
I will say my focus is absolutely directing fiction right sure. now. Yeah. But there are elements I love to all of it. I mean, mm-hmm. my greatest love in life, you know, my greatest passions are films and travel. So I also really do enjoy getting to travel the world and try to figure out how to make certain little scenes interesting. But, you know, and then working on documentaries is fascinating because in 90 minutes, you perhaps get to change someone's opinion about something or open a world to them that they wouldn't know of and open a world to myself, which generally does happen. At least it has on the documentary films I've made. But I will say my number one passion and focus is staying in this narrative world as a director. You know, I'm naturally also a producer, but mm-hmm. yeah. So that's kind of, you know, I'm not planning to like phase out the other. Right. I think yeah. it makes me a little bit more rounded, you mm-hmm. know, which for me I think is good because you learn so much from each, you know, each thing. And I feel like it's so important to live kind of a rich, full life to pull from. You know, and to see the world around you. And I feel like all the traveling I did, I traveled a lot. I was one of those, you know, kids who right out of college with a backpack, I went with my best friend for 3 months to Europe and, you know, and then stayed an extra month and like, you know, did the hostels and, you know, but yeah, it's, you know, it's challenging for yeah. indie filmmakers right now. It's all, you know, I hate having to always be chasing money because that's what right. it's always
But. Was that, well, my next question is, what were the biggest challenges for getting Follower made? Was it really chasing the money?
Totally. 100%. Oh, there was, yeah. Other than that, it really, and because we had so little money, that made it, and we didn't have it. This wasn't a micro budget. You mm-hmm. know, we didn't have 100,000 to make the movie. We had more than that. We were under a million, but considerably under a million, you know. Mm-hmm. So raising the money, I would say, was the toughest. And because we, basically every penny went on screen. Which meant like we all did a lot of jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had to do this film makes me first off say, oh my gosh, I don't want to do a movie with visual effects anymore. Cause like we had over 200 graphics.
Oh, all right. Like, yeah, like all the
self. Oh my yeah. God, the text.
Yeah. And the overlays and yeah.
On
yeah.
Live Hive, all the comments. I'm like, oh my God, it was, you know, thank God we had this amazing, visual effects house called Wild Union Post. I highly recommend them, Alex over there. But just coming up with a chart, and then thankfully we found someone to help us. But yeah, so that was really challenging, and also it was the kind of filmmaking language of the film. And I knew nothing about social media. I was one of those that came into really? Social media kicking. No, I came into social media kicking and screaming, like, why do I have to do this? But my doc background helped me to maybe dig in and say, well, I got to understand it now, you know, because we had to build that world and figure out what the platform she was using, you know, Live Hive, which we created for the right. for the show. And then, you know, the thing that comes up at the end. So, yeah, so all of that was challenging, but it was fun, mm-hmm. you know.
So, Sylvia, I was just wondering, like, Dani wrote the script for herself as a vehicle for herself. And right. then she trusted you as a first-time feature film director. To work with her on this, what was it like figuring things out with her, and was it a what was the process like, and you know, building the trust with each other?
Well, you know, the interesting thing was is we didn't meet for months. You know, we weren't even like Zoom. We were just talking on the old-fashioned telephone. But we would talk hours. Yeah. I know, we would talk for hours at a time. It was before COVID that we met. Had it been during COVID, we would have been doing like this, where you really get to know someone. I don't know why we didn't think of it. We've been in for a long time. So, you know, there was a trust. And it's funny because we brought, you know, a lawyer on to make it all legal. And because we needed to have a vehicle to raise the money. And I remember he was like, wait, you guys are going to be 50-50. Like, you have to agree on everything. And we're like, yeah, he thought we were insane. He's like, doing this a long time, it does sound insane, but how are we going to decide? You know, she wrote the script, I'm directing it. Yeah, I have a lot of producing experience, but now she's acting in it. And, you know, it all worked. You know, obviously, kind of, she got the nod for the screenplay. If there was a, you know, or for the directing, you know, we didn't question each other, but she was really, really collaborative at taking notes on the script. Like, we workshopped the script a lot. You know, just talking through it and, you know, and we shot in two segments, which, you know, as a filmmaker, damn, I kind of recommend it. And I think, would I ever want to do it again? Hell no, but yes, I would. So we shot the whole middle from like 12 minutes in from when they meet in the park until, you know, the lights come up and she's, you know, in March, April, and we didn't shoot the rest until January the next year.
Oh, almost a year in between.
So I went off and made a living doing my travel shows. Yeah. We kept talking. I had an editor, Alex Gans, on the West Coast, who we had a cut of this. Those like 55 minutes in December. Because I went over there, you know, before we started filming again, I was like, you know what? I have to know exactly what we have, what the strengths are, what does her character need? Because she's morally... you know, not even ambiguous. She does some morally kind of, you know, that you might not agree with. So I was like, we knew she wasn't likable, but you needed to at least find her intriguing so you would want to take her journey. And I very much believe in sharing, you know, sharing the film with people. So I shared those 50 minutes with people I really respected. Not a ton, because then you can start to get too many. You know, but that really helps because you know, for instance, things like, well, you know, you are interested in her, but if you could make her a little more likable in those first 10, 12 minutes, you know, that might help. So it kind of was a really neat tool. Like, had we just shot it, bam, 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 I don't know. And we kept rewriting the ending, you know.
Oh, okay. Got interesting.
Yeah. And a lot of that, I have to say, you know, our editor, Alex Gans, really had a lot to do. You know, he and I, like, we spent so much time editing because it was COVID and we're like, what else are we doing? And we would, you know, do this on Zoom and he'd be cutting. And so it was kind of like, you know, really trying to figure out, you know, what this interesting other element to the film is in this other world. And, you know, and then also with our graphics, you know, our visual effects team. And so...
Speaking of that world, if I may ask, this is actually something that maybe Danny would have a better idea about, but maybe you could. But how did Danny come up with the concept, the premise of the story?
Yeah.
Very interesting story. So about 10 or 12 years ago, early, probably, 12 years ago, 12, 13 years ago, she actually had a YouTube series called Starvival. And it was a bit ahead of its time. And basically, it was about a woman who took crazy jobs online and secretly filmed them. Her first episode of that, you know, YouTube series, it wasn't live. That was something that I think I suggested we make it a live stream to make it very right now. But the very first episode of that show, she got paid, God, it was either $25 or $50 to be tickled for an hour. So that actually happened to her. Now, the difference is that she always brought guys with her to be like bodyguards. And she would not show their faces, you know. So there are some similarities. Obviously, that was the lightning rod that went off, you know, for her, was thinking, about how to, you know, about that world. And, you know, so, and I watched before I spoke to Danny the first time, I found some of those episodes. You can still find a bunch of them.
Interesting, and,
yeah. And I remember seeing them, I'm like, oh my God, this girl's crazy. she actually did this. Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, but it was fun because it also grounded it in truth, which for me as a documentary filmmaker, I was like, this is really interesting. And the fact that she was doing this 12 years ago means like the shit at the end, I actually think could be happening.
Yeah. You
know, a lot of that wacky stuff, you know, could be happening, you know.
Right. And yeah. How long before you met did she have the script ready?
So I would say, I think she had it done for about 6 months. I don't think she spent like a huge amount of time.
Yeah.
And she really thought she was going to make the reason John Gallagher first put us together was that when she spoke to him, she said, I'm shooting it in 6 weeks and I have $100,000. And he was like, well, I'm not available in 6 weeks. But if you need a woman to direct it anyway, call Sylvia. She's who should direct it. And so then the first call we had, I was like, well, first off, I don't want to make this movie if it's for $100,000 because I'm not interested in trying to tell this story. She could have made this film. It would be a very different film. We spent almost that just on visual effects, you know, but I've been in the business so long. I just couldn't think of doing a film where everyone works for free and it was all just non-SAG. I just couldn't imagine from where I was. I was like, I can't do it. So thankfully she's like, you know, she jumped on anyway. And then we workshopped the script for about 10 months. And then I brought on Judy Henderson, a great casting director in New York City, who I'd done 7, 8, 9 films with. And that's when we started casting. At the same time, we were still trying to raise money. And of course, we made some Hail Mary offers to actors, famous, you know, name actors. But frankly, I don't think any of them would have been as good as Luke Cook. We would have opened maybe on 1,000 screens or 2,000 screens, but I don't know that the film would be as, you know, as good.
I really enjoyed him. Actually, so I was going through a bunch of your interviews. One of the most interesting things I found was you decided that the first scene that they were going to shoot was the really intense sex scene. Or like, how did that come about? Like, you know, what were the creative decisions behind that? And did it help their chemistry? Which, by the way, have to say is really good. The two of them have really intense chemistry.
Yeah, I know. I think that the whole movie doesn't work if they don't have chemistry. And that was definitely, as a director, I was like, oh my gosh, like they have to have chemistry. So it was one of those happy accidents that then I ran with. So literally the night before, we have call sheets have been sent out. We have a 7 a.m. call. We're starting in the park. You know, the scene where they both meet. And I'm like, oh, it's exactly how you dream of starting this movie. Because they're meeting. It's a long scene, a lot of pages to cover. But with my theater background, there's not that much blocking. I'm like, you know what? This is such a good way to start where I can really work on beats and intentions and the moments and the chemistry, let it build. And then at about like 8, 9 o'clock, I'm checking the weather again and there's like a storm coming in. And I'm like, oh, good God, like, you know, rain. And I'm like, the whole movie takes place in that night. So I'm like, holy shit, it rains. And we don't have the money to have rain throughout. So I was like, oh my God, what do I do? And because of my producing background, I just jumped into like, can't lose a day. That's not how you start a movie. Get it done. Do what you have to. So the first thing I did was I called and I was like, I was in my little house with my cat, staying with two other crew people. And I think I probably came down and was like, oh no, what am I saying? This was there. I think I was like, oh my God, you guys, it's supposed to rain tomorrow. So the first thing I did was I called the production designer. And at this time I'm thinking, well, maybe we can do when they first get to the barn. And she's like, what are we talking about tomorrow? Like we have everything is still in boxes and we're just starting to, and she's like, and I was like, oh, but no, we have to shoot something. And the outhouse wasn't ready. She's like, oh, okay, I can have the bedroom scene ready. And I'm like, the bedroom ready. I'm like, oh my God, are you freaking kidding me? I mean, my first film, I had shot listed the whole movie, but that scene with the DP, I was going to watch Sliver. I had all these movies, these scenes. I was going to watch the next weekend because that was going to be in week 2. And I think it was a really lucky accident. I'll never forget calling Danny and calling Luke, and they were both like, oh my God, I'm not, what are you, what? How, I'm not ready for that. And but they were both professionals. And right. I remember, you know, asking both of them, I said, well, look, we can decide right now. We're shooting that scene tomorrow, not the rain, the one in the rain, but we're deciding on the bedroom so you can go to bed tonight knowing. And both of them were like, fuck no. Can I swear on this? Are we
going to? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So they were both like, hell no. If there's any chance we don't have to shoot that scene, let's not decide until the morning. Yeah. So we all went to bed that night. And I remember thinking, oh, please let the sun come out. But that morning, you know, it looked a little dodgy. But at that point, something in me was like, you know what? Just freaking do it. Just tell them it's too risky. Just go do that scene. And it turns out we totally would have been fine in the park. It didn't even, it was like cloudy. It was exactly the weather we wanted. We didn't want sunshine. We just couldn't have rain.
Right.
And so it actually, I remember that whole day, I'm looking, I'm like, oh my God, this is the weather we actually wanted for that scene. It was just real cloudy and kind of, but I think it was really for the best because
I think so too.
We all had to let go of any inhibitions, any fears. Mm-hmm. You know, and like there was no time for me to be nervous about directing my first scene. It was just like jumping in, you know, and they got pretty comfortable pretty quick. And lines like foot in mouth came out of Luke probably being like, oh my God, the first day he's got a foot in his mouth. And, you know, it's just,
That's so cool.
I think if they had been more comfortable together, it wouldn't have been as good.
Yeah, I think so. Like a happy accident, like you said.
And then I think it set the tone for the rest of the film. And I remember Danny saying that, you know, we didn't finish the entire scene, and we came back the second day to finish mostly her side, like some of her close ups and stuff. And she was like, you know, she felt that really helped her actually, because being able to step away and then come back in the morning, she was more ready. But yeah, I think it was a good, will I do it again? You know, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if I did, you know, you almost don't want to let them prepare. Like, I think that was part of it. It was, you know, they were familiar with their characters. I mean, Danny was very comfortable. She wrote the scene. She'd been in the gym. Like, she's like, I'm going to have no concerns. And there's not barely any nudity. It's not like there's, but they were comfortable, like they knew these characters. We'd had 2 days of talking through the characters, 2 days of rehearsal, which really, you know, we talked through the characters. I was careful never to talk in depth with both of them present because I didn't really want them to know what the other was thinking or what we had in mind. And yeah.
was this the most challenging scene to shoot? Or were there...
Probably. I mean, yeah, even the little thing under the bed took forever. It was like, oh my God, we were hysterical. But it was very funny. Like suddenly Wesley, who I won't say too much, but you know what I'm talking about. We see Wesley, you know, he's under there and he's like, you know, it's low. And he's like, you know, he's trying to be so dramatic. We're like, oh my God, we're not making, you know. So it was very funny. And and I think it just the fact also that Luke and I, the DP, had not shotlisted that film. We were shotlist everything, the whole scene. So, you know, the whole movie. So, but again, we knew these characters. We'd talked about the scene and I knew what we needed from that scene. You know, I was very big on getting ready, doing my prep work. You know, as a producer, I really believe the film, the success of shooting is because of what's done in pre-production. And so I'd had a couple months where I left home. I took my cat. I rented a Airbnb in like Asheville in the mountains so I could just hike every day and write my notes and be very ready. So I had gone through that scene and I knew the beats and the moments we needed to hit. I just hadn't shotlisted it. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was definitely probably the most challenging scene. And then, you know, the very end stuff with him before the lights come up, that was really challenging because it was so rushed. We were running. It was our last half day and we were running out of time. And, you know, but that's, you know, that's the challenge of any film, really. I think even if you have a lot of money and you're shooting for 100 days, you always wish you had more time. But to me, the biggest obstacle of an indie film is time.
Yes.
With a script like this, where it's so much of it is just between these two main characters, did that allow for room for improv for the actors? Is that something they wanted to do, or was it a tighter script?
No, you know, it did allow, but we never really discussed it. But Danny was open to it, and Luke and I, like, for instance, you know, there's a time in the film where his character has a huge shift. Right. You know, in that last like 15 minutes after she's been in the woods and whatnot, and suddenly you're like, oh my God, this guy's like really. So there was quite a bit of improv, and we hadn't really told Danny. Luke and I had early on had a discussion about the fact that his character had to feel dangerous, that there had to be a not so much a craziness behind the eyes, but you had to believe he was capable of anything.
Right.
To keep the tension building, especially because the scene prior, you know, with being outside and then back, like there had to be, it couldn't just be about her being manhandled. Like you had to believe like, oh my God, this guy's kind of capable of anything. So he had told me kind of the day before we started filming that from that, we tried to shoot in order other than the bedroom scene, which didn't always work. But, you know, so he had said to me, you know, Sylvia, I've been working on some stuff and I am planning to take this pretty far. And I have improv some stuff. So just, you know, I encouraged him and said, well, I knew I could bring him in if need be. So she didn't have any idea how intense it was about to get.
Mm.
I've heard her even in interviews saying that suddenly she's sitting there like, this isn't the movie I wrote. Like, this is really different. So that was challenging for her, but
right.
Thank goodness he's so good and he was so invested in it that she just, you know, went with it.
Sure. And her reactions are more genuine, real.
Totally. Because yeah. She was not. I mean, you know, certain things were mentioned about, you know, taking some, you know, pulling hair and stuff, but just the intensity and his, you know, just changing on a dime, you know, some of that and the way we shot, which I talked to the DP about, you know, using the projector in a certain way. And, yeah. So,
and speaking of Luke, is he someone that the casting director found, or did he come in?
He did. Yeah. He was, you know, we knew we were shooting in New York, but we didn't want to, you know, we wanted to open up auditions for anyone in the country, really. And nowadays, everyone's so used to sending video tapes. Mm-hmm. So he sent, you know, it's funny. As I mentioned, we'd put a few Hail Mary offers out, but when we saw his audition, we were like, oh my God, like we each got it separately. I remember, I think I watched it first and I was like, oh my gosh, this guy, like, okay, we could go make our movie. You know, even if we don't get a, you know, he's so good. And so then I remember calling her and she right away felt the same. Like there were a couple other actors that we'd liked, but from that moment on, none of them were even in the same league as far as what we thought he could bring. And I remember like, you know, I was like, well, we can't cast him on his first audition. You know, so I'm like, give him some notes. Let me give him, you know, a couple notes so I can see if he'll take direction. And of course he did. And he was fine, but he was certain he was no better than he was in the first. Like we could have just, you know, gone, you know, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So but yeah.
You had to do your due diligence.
Exactly. Yeah. And then of course I, you know, had phone calls and I think with him, I did a Zoom.
Sure.
You know, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then he was actually in New York. He and while Danny happened to be in New York, so they at least got to meet, and then they Zoomed me, you know, and seeing them together, I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah.
So you kind of touched on this earlier, but I'm going to give you a two-parter question. Okay. So with Danny, I read an interview that you said that her original script was like almost NC-17 if you didn't like do some changes. So for her, how different was it from how she originally intended to be and how it turned out? And then for you as the director also, how different was it for you in your head as compared to when the final product was in?
Right. Because
those are two different things.
Yeah, totally. Well, so, you know, some of the things that changed, and look, a lot of it, the meat of it was in her screenplay. Mm. Two people meet in the park and they go back to the barn and So that was kind of all there. I think what I saw as NC-17 were some of the jobs that she was going to do or take seemed like there would have been a bit more nudity or a bit just more pushing that envelope, which I didn't really feel was necessary. And I felt like, and I think we both agreed that we wanted to get to the barn quick, get to, you know, to meeting the male, you know, the antagonist. I think for her, like, yeah, that's a really good question. I've heard her mention that, you know, that segment we were just talking about, that she didn't see the film quite like that, the intensity of it. And she also, I've heard her say she didn't know she was making a horror film, which I'm like, what? you know, and look, it's, you know, it's not a crazy art. It's more for Miguel, the scaredy pants, because it's not really, it's psychological horror. It has elements. Yeah. But it's really a thriller dressed up as a horror film, maybe.
Yeah.
But my intention always was to make a scary thriller. And I will say, like, the prep I did was thinking, well, how do I keep this interesting? How do I build tension with two people in one location? Yes, I know we have to get an amazing location, which I feel like we found a great location, big, high ceilings, interesting ways to move the camera. But also, how am I going to keep the audience engaged and have them not be like, eh? So I did a lot of looking at movies from all decades, you know, and I settled on some stuff I'd learned from Hitchcock. And now I'm a Hitchcock fan. I've never been like, oh my God, Hitchcock is God. But I started studying his films and reading Hitchcock on Hitchcock and some of that. And the one thing I really grabbed from Hitchcock was, He often let the audience be ahead of his protagonist. And usually it was a woman in jeopardy. And I was like, oh my gosh, that is so it. Like, if I can make the audience lean in, it's also going to help, because maybe she's not that likable, but nobody wants to see her get killed. Like, you know, anyone, that decent person who's watching someone potentially putting themselves in grave danger would be like, wait, get the hell out of there. What are you doing? So I thought, ooh, I like that. So I actually built into the script some places to do that. You know, even like putting so you saw she was being recorded when she's walking to Penn Station to meet her friend who doesn't show up. You know, little things like that, like what we talked about under the bed. You know, that was just something I came up with. You know, the way he locks the door. You know, all of these were bits that I kind of came up with those moments and put them into the, you know, seeing someone on the second floor, which maybe you guys missed. It's one of those things you have to.
No, I saw it. At first, like, I was like, was that a mistake?
No, I know.
And then you're like, oh no.
And so you don't have to see it to get the next minute, but it builds tension when suddenly she's going upstairs and you're like, wait a minute. You know, there's someone.
There's someone up there.
Right. So little things like that, I thought would really help build. Keep this one, you know, room, two actors, you know, help build it. So,
So here's something I really want to know, right? Like, every time I thought that I knew where the story was going to go, it goes in a different direction. Was that one of your singular purposes for the film, was to really subvert audience expectations?
Ooh, my cat just jumped. Mr. Squeakers just jumped up on the table. He's my cat in the movie. Yeah, he's right here. He's trying to get his face on the camera.
That's fine.
Yeah, I have two and they both are hams. So yes, you know, I think that was part of, I think, keeping the intensity alive. And we didn't want to make something that was so important to me. And I'll never forget, I had a moment of concern, of fear, when we finished filming with Luke. That whole section, I was like, oh gosh, I don't want to make a movie about a woman being tortured or being subjected by, like, I want to make a strong woman, maybe not completely moral, but strong. Sure. She's fighting. I don't want to make a victim movie. And that was really, really important to me. And I think part of that is what plays into the back and forth, because at moments you think she has the upper hand, even though physically everybody knows, you know, he's a big guy. He has the upper hand. Physically, however, she's clever. She's a fighter. You know, so that was, I think, maybe something that came came mm-hmm. out of, and Danny felt the same way. We're like, we just do not want to make another female being a victim. Now there are moments where she is victimized.
Yes.
But, you know, I think hopefully it doesn't come off that it's just a female victim movie. You know, she's fighting back. She's put herself into this place and, you know.
Yeah. Well, if I may say, like, that whole time in the barn, that whole part of it, like, it felt like to me, and let me know if I'm reading too much of it, but it felt like a really bad date going really wrong. Like, you know, this is probably how it feels like for women when they, you know, meet up with a guy who seems to have a lot of potential. Then suddenly, he's just a total dick who tries to, who's super manipulative and everything. But you can see also Danny, like, figuring her way out of it. And
in ways
that women usually do, like, you know, by deflecting and...
Right.
So that was very, like, even it's like a date movie, like, this also works. Yeah.
Yeah. No, 100%. And we actually talked about stuff like that and how he uses that on her, you know, to get her to stay, you know, because look, he knows he's been watching her, you know, she's lonely kind of, she doesn't have a boyfriend, she's single, she's getting thrown out of her apartment. Like she's vulnerable emotionally. And he definitely does use that. But then, you know, she also kind of tries to look, she's putting cameras, like, you know, she's, you know, even when they go upstairs into the bedroom, those glasses come down, like, you know, she's not she knows what she's doing. And her need to make a provocative, like, great episode is more important. She chooses that's more important in a sense than her safety.
And survival.
And I think that's a very interesting topic, because I do think in today's world with technology and people, I think do cross those lines much easier than they would have. I was like, you know, when I was a kid, we used to hitchhike sometimes, you know, to find out what to do, but we were very careful what cars we got into. Like if it looks, you know, but nowadays, you know, you meet people online, you're trusting someone you really don't know. And then, they're really this handsome Australian guy. And, you know, really funny thing is that I know I told you how we shot those 50 minutes and how I shared it with a small handful of people to get their thoughts. So, you know, maybe it was 50-50 men and women. The only people that we ever got a comment, she would never have followed him she wouldn't have gone with him to his barn, were men.
Right.
All the women were like, I probably would have gone. And these weren't like men in their 20s. These were, you know, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, you know, people that had been in the business or, you know, and I'm like, they're projecting their wives or their daughters. And they're like, no way would they do. And the truth of the matter is, you know, when you find yourself in that circumstance, you've been pushing the bar on what you do or won't do. And so I think that's a really interesting, you know, topic.
And it's the reason I really like the tagline you have in the poster, the you want to be famous, right?
Right. What will you do?
I wanted to ask about the barn and the location. You mentioned that you were able to find this great location, and it is great. The design, even the artwork, I feel sort of adds a little dimension to the scene. How hard was it to find this location? Because at first I thought it was a set that you guys had built, so you could control the entire, you know, temperature and, you know, the lighting.
Oh, that would have been so great. But I don't know if it would have been as good. So, you know, we were both, you know, Danny was in New York City, I was in Florida. So we both started looking on Airbnb and VRBO. Mm. And I think we had another barn first, much smaller, also gorgeous, really cool barn, about an hour closer to the city. And then we lost it. They're like, I don't know what happened. They got scared. Who knows? And then we found this barn. I think Danny was the one that saw it on VRBO and sent me photos. And I was like, oh my gosh, this looks amazing. And it had like that shed that became the outhouse. And we had to bring in that piano. That was like the biggest thing we had to do, is we had to rent that piano. And then we brought in all the artwork. They had a few wacky things, but I actually found an artist in town. I was walking around town, you know, thinking about dressings for the set. And we had a great production designer. And I walked by not a gallery. It was like a little shop that sold paintings. And I saw one of those crazy paintings with like the skull. And I was like, oh my God. I went in and asked him. I was like, who is that, a local artist? And it was. So I reached out, and then Noah, the production designer, I went to his studio, and like his artwork is all over the movie. It's all over the barn, and it's in the art gallery.
Right. Scene, the final the shot of the scene.
Yeah.
Which for me was a little bit of a red herring I was planting, because we also thought people might think this is something her father's done to scare her. And so if they're like, wait, that artwork was kind of like the artwork in the gallery, you know, it might, So it was a little bit of a red herring having the same style of art in two completely different places. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, that barn was such a major, you know, in the woods. The thing about it was that it had a lot of, on three sides of it, it looked out onto woods. But the other side was like, there was the road. You know, it wasn't a super busy road, but we had to, you know, with visual effects, like paint out lights and stuff. Because like when she's running back from the barn and there's cars going by, we're like, oh, well, that kind of kills it, you know. And it limited, like, you know, we would have done a lot more drone footage of the house, but there was just no way to
see the road.
The road, and then there were, you know, over their big field, then you would see houses and but it offered so much, and they were great. In fact, I convinced, you know, the owner to invest in the movie, you know, instead of charging us the full rate to rent his place, because we house crew in there. He put back in some of the money as an investor.
That's so smart. Nice.
And like, I think the crew that stayed in that house had the most fun of anyone on the movie. Towards the end of the shoot, they were playing the piano every night and having, you know, parties out there and out. Yeah.
Sleepover camp.
Yeah. So yeah, we had like five people staying in there.
You mentioned Hitchcock earlier, and that's very felt in the film, the surveillance, the paranoia.
Right.
Were there any other influences or touchstones that you looked to when you were in pre-production?
Yeah, you know, there's a few films. Have you guys seen The Strangers?
Yes.
Oh, you have?
Liv Tyler, yeah.
Yes, Liv Tyler. Right. Have you guys seen it?
I have not.
Yeah, a while back, the one with the masks.
So it's about the three strangers who show up at a house, and they're there for no other reason but to terrorize two people they don't know. They just want to. And that movie is so friggin' scary. Like, you probably could watch it.
Yeah, I don't think Miguel can take it.
No, I don't think you want to see that movie. So there are moments from that movie that I was like, oh my God, I need, you know, like that terror. And that also, they used a little bit of that Hitchcock thing, because there's moments when he goes away and Liv Tyler's alone and she's in the kitchen and you suddenly see the guy standing in the kitchen and you're like, we do that too in the film, one or two places. But, you know, so that, I also really loved the film It Follows, which
I heard
about it. I was like, this sounds kind of stupid, but it was so well done. I actually really did. Yeah. And my composer, I definitely had him watch that movie specifically thinking about score, because I just thought that score was so great. And then also, the movie where there's two others, Don't Breathe, you know,
very cool.
They had so much money that, like, if I could have had that budget, like, that was a set, like, they could, you know, they had pulleys, like, they had a lot of money to do stuff. But that film was definitely, especially with the lights out part. And the film Lights Out is a really creepy good movie. And then the movie, it's with John Goodman, and the woman is trapped. She gets into a car accident, and then she's trapped in his basement.
Cloverfield Lane.
Which one?
Cloverfield Lane.
Cloverfield Lane.
Yes, Cloverfield Lane. That one, I think I probably told Luke to look at that. What I loved about that movie is that you've got, you know, the antagonist's face, and he could go from, like, you know, goofy, lovable to suddenly like, oh my God, this guy's friggin' insane. He's going to kill them, you know? So I liked, I really liked that and how they use the space.
Right.
So those
very confined, yeah.
Yeah, confined, and him changing on a dime, which I really liked, and how strong she was and how much she fought back. Right. You know?
The actor there is John Gallagher Jr. Is he any relation to the...
No. I know. That's so funny. Yeah. No, I like that actor. Yeah. I loved that series he was in.
The Newsroom?
The Newsroom. Yeah, the first
year. Oh, that guy. Producer, was he? Yeah.
The young guy.
I had one last question about deleted scenes, because I sort of... I'm maybe wrong, but I thought I saw the brother. Is he a DJ and they live together? No.
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay. That was just a random guy in a window. There's a sort of drone shot that I thought was establishing her apartment, which was owned by the dad. And there's a guy there, but we never really see him in the film, right? So I thought, I was wondering if that was her brother.
Sorry. Yes. So he sends her the email. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, she's on the computer
she gets an email from him. Yeah, you know, that was one of the things we actually struggled with. And that nightmare scene came in and out of the movie a bunch of times. It was out. And then we're like, you know what? We need a little jolt, a little something. We got to add a little tension to the apartment stuff. So then it went back in. And then literally like a month before the movie came out, I don't know, it probably wasn't worth it. I was like, you know what? I want to take a couple minutes out of the movie. There's a few things that kind of bugged me.
Got it.
I was like, what? Like, are you serious? I'm like, yes, for the rest of my life, this movie's going to be out. And was it worth it? Probably not. I just had to make myself crazy. You know, so we ended up trimming, like, the way we get into that nightmare. There was it was a minute longer or a minute and a half. And so there are some, but there's not a lot of like full-on deleted scenes. No. Mm-hmm. No.
And they were deleted more for like pacing, or you wanted it to be more isolated? Okay.
Throughout, or are you talking specifically about the nightmare?
Go ahead, get the answer. No, just like the timing. The, in general. Yeah.
Timing. Yeah. Pacing. Like there was more that we trimmed of her in the chair when she's kind of tied and he's filming. We got rid of some of that stuff because I was just like, okay, we got to get through this quicker and have those, you know, the lights come up. And so we tightened there a bit. And, you know, yeah, my editor and I've always been of the school, you know, get into a scene late and leave early if you can. Mm. And better leaving them wanting more than being like, okay, we get it. And so I did tighten a lot. And because it was during COVID, I had the drives all here. So I was looking at takes and telling the editor, hey, wait, I think this half of a, you know, this line, she's actually better in this take. I think I made him a little, you know, crazy, but I, you know, what else was I going to do at COVID, you know?
That's the creative process.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to be reading off this just because I don't want to make a mistake. So Follower has done very well in the festival circuit, right? It says, Film Quest and the Austin Film Festival, where it won the Audience Award for Dark Matters Feature. And so far, please correct me if I'm wrong, if this is not updated. Yeah. The film has won 6 Audience Awards, 5 Best Film Awards, and more than a dozen other awards on the film festival circuit. Is that correct? And something how has like that experience been? Yeah.
It's won like 19. Yeah, you know, it's so funny because, you know, you make a film and you think, gosh, is anyone going to like it? And you wait to get into a festival and then, you know, you don't get into South by Southwest or so, you know, and you think, maybe it's not. And then you start getting into these other really good festivals and you start winning awards. I mean, our first festival was in Portugal, was Fanasporto, and we went, we had a lovely time, beautiful place where we were there. Danny came with me, which was so fun. The two of us, we spent 5 days and then we go home and I'm on a shoot. And then we get an email that we won 3 awards. We're like, what? You know, we won, I think, the jury award for best film, best actress. Oh my God, I don't even remember what the other one was. Oh, and the audience award. Sorry.
Yeah.
And so to me, I was like, oh, the audience award, that means so much because, you know, that's the audience, you know, that's, you know, I think that was important because also I had really questioned. I would sometimes say, God, are we stupid to be submitting to horror film festivals? Mm. You know, and I think some festivals we were not horror enough, you know, sure. But the majority of festivals, like really great festivals, you know, like Fright Fest in London or Fanespo in Brazil that are horror festivals, you know, we got in. I was like, oh,
yeah,
cool.
Well, Ramon can relate to you. His film won an audience award too. Ramon's a writer. Those are really rewarding films, right? I mean, really rewarding awards, right?
They are. Yeah. Cool. Oh, neat. Well, I'll have to try to see it.
Yes, Ramon, please.
What's the name?
It's called What Isn't There?
Ooh.
But it's not a horror. So much. Yeah. Unless social.
Is it out yet, or is it doing? Are you still doing festivals?
Oh no, it was about a decade ago, but we're still figuring out some of the legal things to get it streaming.
On streaming, yeah.
It's not easy. I'll tell you. No, making indie film is really freaking all the business side of it kind of stinks. Mm.
Okay, well, we're kind of wrapping up. This has really been a really awesome interview with you, Sylvia. You know, as I said, it's quite the honor to have you on. I quite enjoyed the film, and I hope it gets a wider release at some point, or also in the Philippines.
Yeah, we're working on the rest of the world. We have foreign sales agents working hard. You know, fantastic. Right now it's streaming in North America, so U.S. and Canada. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not easy, you know. So the better the film does here, you know, the better chances it has of getting to the rest of the world. But we have some other things happening, you know.
Are you working on anything new that's about to come out that you want to talk about also?
I am. I mean, I'm not shooting, but I've been so busy on working on one script that I'm writing with a novelist.
Right.
It's, you know, a sci-fi time travel series. It's so good. It's a series of 7 books. He's the first 4 are out, and he's writing the 5th. And together, we're adapting the first one.
Is this for a TV series, or is it going to come out?
We're writing it as a screenplay.
Oh, okay.
But if Amazon or anyone like HBO Max, you know, wants to say, hey, I think that it should be a series, but that's so much harder to, you know.
Right.
So I'm working on that. And then another real much more straight horror film called It Walks Among Us, with like a creature, you know, that takes over people, and really interesting, a little bit, not a lot of gore. I'm not really into like slashers, but there's some, there's definitely some, you know.
I'll watch it.
Yeah, you know.
I'm excited. Yeah. That sounds like it's really in my bag. Cool. Creature features. Yeah. I love creature features.
Yeah, me too.
Well, you know, Sylvia, it's been an exciting hour. So glad you replied and agreed to come on.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you guys. Yeah, I'm definitely going to go back. I met Eric Penikoff, I think your last guest.
Oh, yeah.
I think we were both at Fright Fest I dig The Leech. Great film.
Yeah, The Leech. Yeah, it's a really good film.
It is. It's really good.
That is cool. That's so cool that you guys know each other.
We met on the festival circuit. Yeah.
So cool that we get to talk to you guys.
We're very happy.
Yeah, well, podcast doing this is really important for indie films, because we certainly don't have money to be spending on social media ads and huge buyouts and stuff. So this really helps. So it's always great. So thank you for doing the show.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we go, is there any place where we can find you online so we can follow your work?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm on Twitter under just my name, at Sylvia Kaminer. And then on Instagram, I have a production company I've had for about a dozen years, and that's called Dolger Films, Dolger. So that's how you find me on Instagram, at Dolger Films. And then the film, at Follow Her Film. And if you remember that one only, you can, you know, find me off that. I'm on a lot of those, you know, those things.
Fantastic.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Cool. Well, thank you very much. This was awesome. Right. This was great.
You have a good night.
All right. You too.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.